some of them. Yeah, okay.
I don't trust my watch. Am I got a correct time?
10:45 and 47.
10:45? We start at 10:45. Okay. Did the bell ring? It rang. Let's roll the tape. My name is Pete Steinke. The title of this session is Getting the Love You Want. I'm taking a little bit of an interlude from what I have been doing to introduce you to a new concept called Imago Psychology. This has been developed by Dr. Harville Hendricks, a Methodist minister and a psychotherapist, who for a period of time was a professor at Perkins School of Theology in Dallas at SMU. Dr. Hendrick was on the Oprah Winfrey Show back in February or March for two sessions. Oprah won an Emmy Award for these two segments, and it is being replayed on Thursday and Friday of this week. If any of you go back, I don't know, what do you say when you leave here? To the mainland or off the island or out of the hills or out to the outside world and civilization? I hate to say that because I think we're civilized.
Unreal.
If you're there Thursday and Friday, you may want to take a look at the Oprah Winfrey Show. Dr. Hendrick had a fascinating life in the sense that his mother died early in life. So he recognized he had a deep fear of abandonment. He went through a severe divorce after 17 years of marriage and spent about 6 years in just reading all the kinds of material that he could gather as to what goes on in a love relationship. Out of that came what he calls imago psychology. And there are two things I'm going to have you focus on. One will be, what is the imago and how is it formed? And then secondly, how that affects the stages of a love relationship. What is the imago? The imago is the internalizing of the positive and negative traits of your primary caretakers. Whether we like it or not, the apples do not fall far from the tree. We internalize from these powerful figures both their positive and their negative traits. What I'd like to do at this point is to come up with an imaginary person. And if you would just list some of these traits or something from your life, and we'll come up with an imago, and then I'm going to show you how this plays itself out in a relationship. The square stands for the male. The circle stands for the female. So if you would just give me some... there's going to be a composite of this whole group, some negative traits of your father. This may be difficult for some people because we idealize our parents, but we're not judging our parents. We're just describing them.
Control.
Keep going.
Emotionally guarded.
Wow, we're going here. What was that again?
Emotionally guarded.
Negative outlook. Okay.
Disapproval.
I'm sorry, repeat that, please.
Disapproval.
Disapproving.
Disapproving.
Disapproving. All right, let's just get one more.
Stubborn.
We had a Norwegian or a German father. Okay. Let's list some negative characteristic traits or qualities then for mothers.
Domineering.
Too eager.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Stubborn. Manipulative. One more.
Passive.
Okay. Now let's list some positive traits for father. Hard working. Fun and strong will. All right, now let's do some positive traits for mother.
Nurturing.
Nurturing.
Patient.
Did you say patient?
Right. Okay.
Kind.
Teaching. Okay, that's a role. Could you say something?
Kindly.
Empathetic.
Empathetic. One more.
Present.
Okay. Now, I need one person to volunteer this, because we only need one response. What did you need or want as a child and did not get? Now, I'm not talking about $1 million or the Mercedes. I'm talking about emotional, relational things. What did you...
Approval from my parents.
Okay. We'll just put approval here. All right, now I'd like you to recall some childhood traumas or major disappointments and as early in life as you can remember, and what was the reaction? Can you remember any childhood traumas and reaction? Pardon? Okay, that was a trauma. You remember your reaction? Let's do more in terms of a relationship disappointment.
My sister who was domineering and kind of pounded on me. And
okay, what was your reaction?
I was rebellious.
Rebellious. Okay. Somebody else? Yes. And what was your reaction?
Feeling very unstable, or that my home was unpredictable. Emotionally, my parents were not there for me. Everything was unpredictable.
Okay, and your reaction would have been, did you have fear? Did you cry? Or?
Fear and withdrawal.
Okay, fear and withdrawal. All right, one more. Yes. Okay. How did that manifest itself? A little more...
Just not feeling in place anywhere.
Not feeling in place, okay.
Comfortable with friends.
All right. I need a more of a reaction. Did you fight with other children? Did you...
Probably more passive.
Passive, okay. Well, we got withdrawal. Anybody else? Withdrawal, passive... Any other childhood traumas, and what was your reaction to the trauma?
Being having the Lutheran church shut down my throat.
And your react, your
response was to
regurgitate.
Run away.
Run away.
Withdrawal.
Withdrawal. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Listening to the fights of my mother and father.
And your reaction. Okay. All right. Now I'd like you to remember your positive childhood memories, and what was your response? Positive childhood memories.
Vacations to New England.
And your response?
A good feeling about extended family.
Good feeling. Okay. Joy?
Comfort.
Comfort, okay.
Acceptance.
Someone else, a positive childhood memory, and what was your response?
I remember my father taking me for a walk every day.
And your response?
Feeling special.
Feeling special, okay. Let's do just one more so we have five.
All summer spent on a farm, the world belonged to me.
World belonged to me, okay. All right, now this is a composite imago of this group. When I use this with couples, each of the individuals will do this for him or herself. Then these are actually answers to five statements that I give to them. And I want to illustrate that for you now, because this is how one becomes acquainted with one's imago. The first question will be, our statement is, I am looking for a person who. Well, right away everybody gets excited because it's the negatives. I am looking for a person who is controlling, emotionally guarded, short-fused, negative outlook, disappointing, stubborn, domineering, too eager, stubborn, manipulative, passive. That doesn't seem to fit, but it's true. Now, that means that you are choosing a partner who has some of these traits. If you do not pick a partner who has these traits, you will perceive your partner to have these traits, or you will provoke your partner to have these traits. You pick, provoke, or perceive your partner to have these traits. Now, this makes sense because it is out of these negative traits that forms the unfinished business of childhood with your primary caretakers. And you are out to get those issues resolved or healed in this new, intimate, highly emotionally charged relationship called marriage. Everyone who comes into marriage has a baggage of unfinished business with their primary caretakers. They want to finish it up with their partner. It has the potential of being either A, destructive, or B, creative. And it all depends on what the individuals do with the baggage they bring and put in a pile to deal with.
Knowing what we know sitting here right now, if any of us went into a second marriage, would we have a better chance of avoiding those things?
It would all depend upon you again. We know that the same issues are alive in the second marriage as in the first marriage. The magic is how you handle it, what you do with it. So divorce and remarriage isn't always an answer to solve everything, because I'm still going to bring the same baggage to the relationship. You may be able to handle it better if you have an awareness of what is yours and what is your partner's. When I first got married, I had no awareness of that. All right. I am looking for a person who, and then these particular traits, in order that he or she might be hardworking, loving, dependable, fun, strong-willed, nurturing, patient, kindly, empathetic, and pleasant. Okay. Now, one of the problems in marriage is we retain this childhood sense that my partner will know what I need just as my parents did when I was a child. Therefore, if you know what I need and you don't give it to me, that means you don't want to give it to me, which means you don't care about me. But as I said in another session, as an adult, your needs are no longer your rights. Your needs as an adult become your responsibility. But if my needs are not fulfilled, what do I think? It's because you know what they are and you don't want to give them to me, and therefore you don't care about me. But really the whole issue begins with right here, this person, not asking for what one needs. But this is what I want the person to be like. Okay, the next question is, in order to get, I'm looking for a person who, so that they might be, in order to get, approval. You might say C is the bottom line. This is the childhood wound. The childhood wound. You see, our parents, no matter how good or loving or effective they are as parents, never can meet all of our needs. It's just impossible. So we all have some nurturing deficits, some needs that were not fulfilled. And there's usually one major need. What is fascinating here, and this is what attracted me originally to Dr. Hendrick's theory, was that the two partners who join together in marriage have the same childhood wound. Now, I may do this with people and they'll have different words here, but as I begin to get them to unpack it, it's the same childhood wound. But, this is the other fascinating aspect, even though they have the same childhood wound, each one has defended against that wound in opposite ways. So you've got a tension already sitting there. But that tension, again, has the possibility of either being A, destructive, or B, creative, in terms of what do you do with it. All right. D, I sometimes stop myself from getting this approval that I want by being rebellious, fearful, withdrawn and passive, and desiring to kill the other. Okay. See, you have to look at how do I stop myself from getting what I want. And this would be these particular behaviors. All right. When what I really want, or I help myself get these things and feel good, is comfort, acceptance, feeling special, the world belongs to me. This is your imago. And when I do this with couples and each one has this little map laid out, then I begin to have them take a look at what's the baggage, what are the issues that they're bringing to the relationship, and what is it that their spouse is bringing. That's the imago. Now, let me show how the imago gets played out in the stages of a love relationship in actual functioning and processes between or within these two people in marriage. All people are attracted to one another through romance. Romance is blindness, illusion. Romance is that period where you kind of go out of your mind. Or H.L. Mencken said, romance is that period when you mistake an ordinary woman for a goddess and an ordinary man for a god. Okay. Somebody said to me, well, does that mean we'd never get married if we had some awareness? Well, I don't know if we would or wouldn't, but this is just where it starts. What goes on in this period is a projection process. And I project onto the partner all of these positive traits which I have. Because romance is a love based upon identification. I don't love somebody in romance because they're different from me. That they're an individual in and of themselves. I love somebody to begin with because they're very much like me. You do not get object love until you get over towards here, what was called reality love, is I just love you for who you happen to be, not because of my projections onto you. What is interesting in romance is that there's a lot of good courtship tactics. We do good things to get good things. Okay. I mentioned another session is I don't have a lot of faith in premarital counseling. Because I said, what can you do with two psychotics when you've got two people in another world? What has been your experience of romance? When you've been in love, you know, in that romantic period, what has it been like? Some people talk about, well, you know, it's like a, go ahead.
Total fusion.
Total fusion. All right. Total fusion. Correct.
Prolonged euphoria.
Prolonged euphoria. Feel good and proud about myself. Like I've known you all my life. Yeah, you're special. You're totally different. All right. That's romance. And it is very reactive. Because it's a projection of the positive traits from yourself to the other and the other to you. And you're identifying with each other. Well, sooner or later comes the power struggle. It is inevitable. The honeymoon only lasts for a certain amount of time. What happens now in the power struggle is you begin to project onto your partner your negative traits. That's why I always say affairs are illusions. Because in the affair, what's going on? It's romance. See, it's blindness. The affair always ends when it eventually gets to the power struggle or when the negative traits are being projected on to the other. Okay. Now, there's also a change of tactics. Instead of courtship tactics, now they're blackmail tactics. And instead of doing good things to get good things, we now do bad things to get good things. Just like we did as children. When we didn't get what we want by doing the good things, we resorted to the temper tantrums, knocking over the lamp, or whatever. Here is an issue where people get stuck. And it's a very normal part of the process in the development of a love relationship to have to deal with differences and negative projection. Any questions up to this point? Okay. How do people get out of the power struggle and move toward reality love where they can love each other in and of themselves, not because of stuff that's going on inside oneself? You see, all of this is reactive and it's very unconscious. Well, I like the word awakening. Let me give you an example from my own personal life. My 15-year-old son said to me, "Dad, do you know that when you ask me to do something 4 or 5 times, you begin to whine?" Everybody needs a Nathan. I said, "No, son, I didn't know that." And he says, "Well, I hate it." Well, then I processed that another day with him and said, "You know, when you told me about my whininess," I said, "You know, I don't like whiny people." And I imagine when I was a child and I didn't get my way, I began to whine. And I said, "You held up a mirror to me. You helped me see something about myself that I was not aware of." Well, ironically, about 4 months later, he asked me to do something 4 or 5 times. And what did he do? Started whining. I had a great model. And then I was able to do the reverse processing with him. But that's what I'm talking about, an awakening of aspects of ourselves we're not aware of until someone can hold it up to us. Now, unfortunately, we often hold up that mirror in a very aggressive or a very demeaning or very reactive mode. When my son said it to me, he said it as a matter of fact. Or we hold up that mirror and begin to evaluate the other person rather than just to describe it. That's really key. See, when my son told me, "Dad, do you know that you whine?" he was describing it. He wasn't evaluating me. And when you take away the evaluation, it makes a major difference. It's just saying, "Hey, here's something about you. Even though it's negative, do you see it?" All right. So during this awakening period, I have to become aware of myself, both my positive and my negative traits and characteristics. I have to become aware of my own imago. I have to become aware of my spouse's imago and how we play these things out. Because without awareness, you do not have choice. I would not have been able to deal with my whininess if my son had not told me about it. So awareness is the key to transformation. That does not mean that even though you have awareness, you will transform yourself. But it does mean you cannot transform yourself without the awareness. The next stage is the harder work, and that is the transformation. And what I'd like to do here is just share with you some of the techniques that I use with couples to help them get into the area called transformation. One is called the container. The container is a situation where spouses face each other. They imagine that there's a psychic shield between each of them. There is no way that what one is saying is going to affect or cause a reaction in the other. The person who is receiving the message imagines a large umbrella and wearing a raincoat. They simply can't get wet. Okay. The giver of the message uses all I messages. There can be no blaming, no evaluating, only I messages. And the other partner listens and does not respond. And the person then speaks of one's anger, one's sadness, one's fear, or whatever, but the partner does not react. The partner contains him or herself. Because, as I mentioned yesterday, the reactivity only evokes or triggers more reactivity. When you get reactivity to reactivity, communication ends. The value of this is to allow the partner to freely and openly express feelings and to be heard. And to remember that a lot of those feelings that are being expressed are not always and only related to the partner, but they're very primitive feelings. They go back to the past. I'll give you something that's a clue that can help you. Whatever is repeated is archaic. So when partners continue to repeat the same issue, the same problems, the same way of interacting, it's archaic. It has less to do with the partner. It has more to do with the first intimate, highly emotionally charged relationship, that between the primary caretaker and the individual. Freud called it the repetition compulsion, that we continue to repeat that which affects us, either positively or negatively. Then after the individual lets the anger come out and the partner has heard it, the psychic shield is removed, the raincoat is shed, the umbrella is closed. And at that point, I then ask the couples to play for 3 minutes. That's to debrief, or at least to desensitize some of the feelings that are there. Now, that's very difficult to ask pastors to do. The first response is, well, what do you want me to do? They go right into their head. And so I've learned when I give the instructions not to ask me any questions about how to do this or what to do, but to initiate the action on your own. Play. Play also is a way that we really most intimately get to know one another. So it also restores some of that element of intimacy. Then after the play, I asked the individual who was expressing the anger to ask of the partner two behavior change requests. The partner then has to reflect back to the individual who heard the request has to reflect back to the one asking what was the exact nature of the request. And I ask that the request be both positive and concrete. Not, I want you to love me more, but what would it look like if your partner loved you? Tell your partner what it is that would give you this caring behavior you're asking for. That's another problem in our request of our partners. We ask for things in general. We don't ask for things specifically. Or we ask negatively. I want you to stop nagging me. You see, the minute you do negatives and prohibitions, it's almost instinctive to put up a shield or a defense. Okay. I want you to speak with me in a positive way. It's different from, I want you to stop nagging me. And then the partner says, I can do this for you, or I can't do this for you, or I can do something for you, whatever. Okay? You see the change there is the partner becomes a real person. Now it's not reactive stuff. Now it's more intentional, it's more decisive, it's more responsive. That's one example. I have another one that we can do on the board. Yes. Correct.
And then the one who was received the request kind of says, this is what I can do, this is what I can't do.
Correct. First of all, clear that I've got the message about what you want and what you're asking, and then how much of that I can do or what direction I can do it in or when I can do it or whatever. Correct. Okay, that's called the container. Now, the next example, and we can do this here as a group. Let's have a frustration from your marriage. I am frustrated when you, or would okay. And what do you really want?
Yeah, I guess for her to care.
To her to care, okay. You see now where this all goes back. You start here and focusing where? On what your partner's doing. But underneath it all is what? Something that you need. Let's do another one. Somebody else? I feel frustrated when you... You don't believe in forgiveness?
Well, I was married, but I remember that a big thing was with my husband was that stupid little thing. He wouldn't clean the table.
Wouldn't clean the tables?
Like dinner table, something.
All right. What was your feeling?
Anger.
What was your reactive behavior? Run around?
Just giving, I mean, not talking to him.
Not talking, okay. What was your fear?
Of being controlled.
Being controlled. And what did you really want?
For him to be attentive.
For him to be attentive, okay. I think this gets the idea, doesn't it? Across to everybody. You could do this with your spouse if you wanted to. Sometime, just as an exercise. I am frustrated when, then what was the feeling? What is the reactive behavior? What was the fear? And what did you really want? See, I do this when I do a lot of conflict resolutions, whether with small groups or larger groups. I have people list all their frustrations, and then I immediately ask them to reverse that by saying, I need from you. Because frustrations are unmet needs. That the tension's in you, that I also had the same need he had.
But the underlying fear was to be controlled.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else?
I've got one that bothers me at home and here. When someone fills a garbage can up to the top at home, to me they're saying, that's your job, you're the lonely one in the house, take care of it. And here at camp or in the village, it's the same way. When someone puts dirty dishes in my cleaning closet where I have to clean, they're telling me that you're worthless, you're a lowly person, I'm more important than you are, take care of my junk. And really what I want is someone to care enough about me that to see that I am a person too.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't do that. I can't do it at home and I can't do it here. I can't make myself get over this feeling of worthlessness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and as long as you stay in that functioning position as the worthless one, you're vulnerable to certain situations. That's in you. Okay, you have to remember what your functioning position is in a marriage, just as what it might have been as we talked yesterday in terms of a congregation or a larger system. Well, I can give you a fine example because you mentioned garbage. I will often leave town for 2 or 3 days and give presentations somewhere. And when I return, I have one great fear. My function at home is to take out the garbage. I am the garbologist. But my garbology is very simple. You take the paper bags and put them into the can. What happens when I come home? There are 2 or 3 bags of garbage in the kitchen. I live with intelligent people. They're very industrious. But I function so well as the garbologist that what? They don't function as garbologists when I'm gone. So we get into those functioning positions and tend to stay there. And then, of course, our partner takes the opposite position, and we have this reciprocal relationship going on. Yes?
He might be afraid when you come home, he'd be jealous of the fact that there's somebody else could have a job as well as you.
I couldn't answer that because I haven't had that experience yet, whether I'd have jealousy or not.
Satisfy our needs without really being able to, like what you said, I mean, really open communication said, that's what I need. Because we are used to, as kids, I mean, we think that we are like little kids and our primary, takers, I mean, the mothering figure will definitely just prevent our desires and just be there before we even know what we need. And in reality, as adults, we have to take care of the little child inside, but realize also that we have to be very open and say, that's what I need.
Yes, and it is threatening to ask for what you need because you may not get it, and you may be disappointed. And so then, again, the issue is dealing with yourself. What is so crucial in any emotional system, whether it's marriage, parenting, and parent and child, is that you recognize what is mine, what is yours, and what is ours. And that can be very, very difficult sometimes, especially if there's a lot of fusion as to what is mine, what is yours, and what is ours.
Peter, doesn't this hold true the same, the parish and the pastor?
Yes.
Doesn't that work the same way?
And any emotional system. Yes. Okay. Romance could last from 1 hour to maybe an extended, protracted period. When one person gets in touch with his or her separateness and wants to express it, the romance is beginning to crack. The blindness is beginning to remove itself. Normally, though, this has about a year's length. But there are folks who don't have but maybe a short romantic period. They get into power struggle very quickly. Power struggle can last a lifetime. If people, you know, do not know what's going on and it just doesn't feel good, this is all negative, I'll get out. This is why a lot of most divorces are in the first 5 years. But, you know, some people can live in the power struggle for 10 to 15 years and then make the choice to divorce. So this would be about a year. This will follow it, and this could build up even for 10 years. Now, this period of time here, the awakening, the transformation, the reality of love, when I work with people in marital therapy, I like them to stay with me for at least a year. I'd prefer 2 years. This is seeing couples say just about 40 times a year or 45 times a year. Because change is gradual. Change is not that immediate. And I need to spend time helping them to understand their system, what's going on between them, rather than to keep focusing on the partner. See? see. You know, I don't believe in this old thing we used to have in the church where the divorced person who was the innocent party could remarry. I think that was the church's way to justify how you remarry divorced people.
Sure.
I mean, honestly, there's only very rare cases where you're going to have one culprit. I mean, this is something that all folks bring together. Tom, you had another... Yes, in the awakening and the transformation, this is not all pleasant. It can be very painful.
On that power struggle, is it possible for one person in marriage to stay in the power struggle and the other person to kind of drop out and just not participate in the power struggle?
One, in a sense, yes. One could no longer be reactive to the other. But like I said yesterday, there are one of three things you're going to do with that. You're either going to triangle other people or a substance or something else into the relationship to take care of that anxiety, or you're just going to totally distance yourself, which then cuts you off from intimacy, or you're just going to give in, be compliant, and fuse.
So you would not have a good relationship.
You wouldn't have a healthy, functioning relationship. People wouldn't be getting what they needed. Yes. I believe I did. You're asking, is there really an honest mismatch? Can we describe something? In my own thinking, I would say there could be, especially if someone is mentally ill. One does not have the capacity to relate because of an illness. Outside of illness or some other impairment, retardation or something, I don't believe in mismatches.
What I'm thinking of are the cases where I've often come across somebody marries in their teen years, and developmentally they're you know, at an accelerated rate, they're becoming different people, and you know, 4 or 5 years later they realize that they're attracted to very, in some ways, very, very different people, and they do. And then I've seen those marriages work out, and I'm wondering if that would... Incomplete, in a sense, an incomplete development of one's own person, but making a momentous decision to get with someone that may be attractive at that stage of life, but it is so much unfinished business in terms of development.
Yeah, all early marriages tend to be fusion. Someone is marrying someone else to escape more than likely a bad, dysfunctional family, but all one is doing is recreating the dysfunction in the relationship again. And true, someone who's 16, 17 has less awareness, less skill to deal with the power struggle, etc. But you can have people who can be emotionally immature even when they marry at 35. Wouldn't have to be 17. Yes, the degree of maturity has a lot to do with how one gets through these stages. About a mismatch. Yeah, maybe a 16-year-old married to a 25-year-old is a mismatch. But why did she marry the 25-year-old? See, what is the wound that she wants to get healed? Well, she's not aware of it, no more than any of us were aware of it, and goes in with less equipment and capability to deal with it.
Maybe I can just comment in a different way. In some countries, matches are arranged by parents.
Correct.
Person ends up pairing with someone to deal with those wounds, and had they worked through, they never would have chosen that person. And that's
That could be very true. What is interesting is that romance has not been the criterion for marriage until about 100, 150 years ago. See, you marry somebody because they love each other. The marriage was for some kind of closeness, some kind of intimacy. Okay, and I'm sure even in marriages that were made by parents, that they had to go through a power struggle. All right, or maybe they did have some kind of romance that developed. But we in our society, you get married when you love each other. And I think one of the most telling phrases is when people get serious. Isn't that interesting? People get married when they get serious. And yet the way to get close is to get playful. And the marriage, I think we in the church sometimes fall into the romantic trap. You know, two people, what were the old words? I plight thee my troth. We've dispensed with those words because we thought two people were giving each other a disease. But, you know, I pledge to you my trust. The emphasis was what? Commitment. Had nothing to do with love. Or love can always be a part of commitment, but the major part was the commitment. We don't come to hear two people talk about how much they are romantically in love, but that they're making a commitment. And I can tell you this because one of the exercises I have in transformation is that they have to close the exits. How do you find ways to escape intimacy and closeness with your partner? And most of the ways is some kind of over-involvement, an over-involvement with a person, work, hobby, substance. It's a way for me to escape. And I want them to close the exits. It's an exercise that they do. Because the energy has to be put in here. I don't know there are mismatches. I would say there are people who have difficulty putting it together.
Could you go a little bit over what, when you talked about fusion, fusion relationship? Maybe you went over it yesterday.
Yes, but I can tell it to you. Fusion is when you can't tell where you begin and end and where your partner begins and ends. That you get stuck together and you confuse this stuck togetherness, which is a lot of dependency and codependency, for actual love. And when you get fused, it's harder for you to see the other as a separate person.
How does that, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of fusion language when we talk about marriage.
Yes, there is. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? And I'm going to go on to... Yes?
I just have one question on the power struggle. Are you saying that we should be looking at all frustrations, however minor they might seem, even in our own mind, to see if that frustration might be indicative of a larger fear?
Good question. I would pay most attention to the issues that are repeated. Because it's the archaic stuff that gets repeated. It's the archaic stuff that wants to be healed with your partner. I mentioned yesterday that ministry is occupational therapy. I think marriage is therapy too. Can be good therapy. Can you get some healing with one another? Can be a very therapeutic process. And I kind of believe that we have maybe 4, 5, 6 marriages. And if you don't, you know, I think there's a problem. That at one stage, this is who we were as a couple. At another stage, this is who we were. Now, I can give you the example. I'm the 3rd of 6 children. And my role in the family was the mediator. Everybody likes me. I know how to make friends, do all that stuff. That's my role. So when I was growing up, I was a fuser. All right? I never was attracted to a woman who liked me. I always went after the isolator. See? That was unknown to me. She had what I didn't have. And so I found her very attractive. The woman to whom I'm married now, we dated for about 5 months, and she told me I was getting too serious. So we stopped dating. Then about 3 months later, she sent me a note, and it said, "Dear Persistence," She could have said, "Dear Fuser, why don't you come and get this book that you left here?" All right, now what was she doing? The role was reversed. She was now doing the fusing, pursuing side. Didn't take but a few minutes to get together again. We dated for another year, and then we broke up. About 6 months later, we're back together again and engaged. We're engaged for 6 months, engagement's broken. Okay. We get back together again, she's ready to let go. And I said, the hell with this. This is over. 2 weeks later, we got engaged again. Okay. Now, when I look back, it was very painful and sometimes very pleasurable. But when I look back at that courtship, that was necessary. We had to learn to have opposite roles with one another and to do that kind of processing. And if we didn't do it in the courtship, we would have continued doing that in the marriage with maybe greater consequences.
So how did you, before you got married, what was your awakening?
Well, I wasn't that aware, you see. But I was living out this process of shifting roles and positions, functioning positions, which then allowed us to have some sharing and was more functional relationship. But as long as I was pursuing and she was distancing, we had a very rigid relationship. It wasn't functioning. Because in good functioning relationships, you can shift roles. You can shift functioning positions with at least some flexibility. Was another hand. I had to do the same thing when I went into the ministry because I tended to be reverend friendly and to fuse with the congregation. Okay. And then I had to learn how to do my separation there. And I can remember I used to preach and always wondered, well, how did people like it? Couldn't wait to get to the door, you know? And if somebody didn't say good sermon, I appreciated that, I felt bad. I was focusing on other people. And I've learned now that I'm going to present what I have. This is my gift. This is who I am, regardless if somebody says something or doesn't say. But that was a process. It's painful. But I had to learn how to be more separate. I had to learn how to be more of the first child, to be one who could claim one's separateness. And we all have those issues. See, it's not to say I was defective and my wife was effective. I mean, I was ineffective. She was effective because she could be independent. She had to also learn how to diffuse, to chase. Okay? Everybody has issues. Everybody has something they're working on. And the key is how you handle it, what you're doing with it. All right? Now, let me see. There are other kinds of exercises I do with transformation. I don't want to do 10 anymore. I will mention one, and that is caring behaviors. I ask one of the partners to ask the other partner for a caring behavior. I will feel cared for when you. And I ask the person to make it, again, positive and concrete. Because we always expect our partner to know what it is that we want. We expect our partner to know how it is with us when we're being or we're feeling that we're being cared for. I have to inform my partner. I have to awaken my partner to what it is that you do. That the end result is I feel cared for by you. And again, I'll give you a simple illustration. I used to take my wife out to eat a lot. Finally, one day she says, I also need to go to the symphony. Okay, I took her out to eat because that's what I like to do, and I thought she liked it. And she did. But she informed me that there were other ways that I could express my care for her. I need to go to the symphony. See, again, I wouldn't know that. Now, some people reject this notion. If I have to tell him what it is to be cared for, what good is this marriage? It takes out all of the element of surprise, etc. Well, anyway, that's back to the romance stage. You should know what it is that I need. and what it is for me to feel cared for. Again, it's your responsibility to inform your partner. This relates to another issue. We find that marital couples, the least information they have about their partner is their partner's childhood. And it's the most important information they need. And one of the first things we do in awakening is a whole exercise to find out about the partner's childhood. What was it like to be you in that family? Then you get a lot of family of origin information, a lot of family of origin issues, and you begin to know who your partner was as a child. That's so important to get that information. Okay. Anything else on the caring behavior that I just mentioned? Asking your partner for what you need. Now, reality love is more of an ideal than an actuality. This is where I disagree with Dr. Hendricks. He feels that that can become a reality. One might touch it once in a while or have brief experiences of it, but I still think it's more of an ideal where I can totally love you as an object in and of yourself, or I love you for who you are. I mean, that's a goal. I think there's just a whole lot of stuff that we bring into this relationship, but there are times when we get some touch of a reality love. I love you in your reality as you are as an object, not because you just give me pleasure through my identification with you. Okay. And that takes a certain amount of maturity to get to that end. Okay, any other questions or comments about imago psychology, love relationships? Yes. Well, it's very biblical. The sins of the father are visited upon the children of the third and fourth generation. Yes, it's true. I'm going to mention this again. The system repeats itself unless or until there's an intervention, until someone makes a change. This stuff gets recycled. You got the other stuff, yeah. But again, it's... there's a tremendous sense of satisfaction, power, when you can deal with the issues and you do work them out. But you can also change some of this. Even if you make a 5% change, it's a significant change. I don't have to be stubborn. Okay. I can make some choices, but I can't do it without awareness again. Pardon?
Willingness. Because I read the book and I loved it. It's really, really, really. I'm passing it around to all my friends because it's something that people really should be aware of. But
what's
my problem, this one, Getting the Love You Want, by Dr. Hendricks.
Yeah, right. And you have the book?
Not here. I have it somewhere.
Okay. What you're saying is, having this awareness, I don't want to fall in love again. I want to go with my eyes open, and I want my partner to go with some eyes open, to get out of the psychoticism. And that's very valid. I do this with a lot of singles. Okay, the one thing that they usually push me on, but after a while we get to understand, and that's what I'm saying, is marriage is wonderful because it's our last best chance to grow up. See, and I say to singles, you cannot grow outside of a relationship. I'm not saying outside of marriage. But you have to have somebody over against whom you're dealing with these things to grow up. You can't grow up in a vacuum.
other one's going to feel it. It's like what I'm trying to Al-Anon on, and I was the only one in the family, and it, they kind of got a hold of my coattail. As I changed, things changed between us, the people in the family, and they began to make some small changes.
Uh-huh. Well, I will still stay. If you change, you change the whole marriage. If you change, you change the relationship. One can do it, yes, to some degree. Now, it may be that you want to make a change and the other forces resist the change and will not change or only make very minor change. What do you do? You know, I can't answer that question for anybody. I never suggest divorce or not divorce or whatever. I'm just saying you have to make that choice for you. Is it so painful that to stay in the relationship can only be destructive as far as you see? And people are being hurt. I mean, what happens when there is an abusive father, let's say, in a family, and doesn't change? You know, does the wife retain the marriage and protect the sickness of the father for, you know, the sake of not getting divorced? Or is that a higher destruction? You know, there aren't always clear-cut decisions in those issues. Norma? Yes, a deep friendship. Be worked on, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you only grow when you rub up against something, when there is some frustration. Oh, I think marriage is the crucible to do it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you care enough about that person to want to be her friend?
Well, you're gonna work it out, whatever.